HubZero.org, a platform for scientific collaboration. You can follow along with this presentation by going to HubZero.org and downloading the corresponding slides. Enjoy the show.
Our first speaker is Kati Borner from Indiana University, and she's going to be telling us about the Atlas of Science. Welcome, Kati.
Good morning, everybody. I have a question for you. I would like to understand how many of you have seen a map of science before coming here. A map of our collective scholarly knowledge, a map that shows the structure and evolution of science itself. So I saw like 5-6 hands. Next question is, how many of you have knowledge about the Vivo National Researcher Network? All right, 3, 4, another hand. No double counting, please. All right, so I have too many slides, and it comes down to, I tell you, either more about science of science studies, trying to understand the structure and evolution of science using scientific means, terabytes of data, serious cyber infrastructure, lots of interesting algorithms that do all kinds of interesting things to data, and then also rendering the results via these kind of maps of science. Or, on the other hand, I can tell a little bit more about the Vivo National Researcher Network, the Facebook for Scientists, which tries to get very high quality institutional data to the semantic web so that many more scientific studies, but also scientific services become possible. So I have these two choices, and I can speed up either one set of slides. They're all in here. You will all get those slides at the end. But I have to make a choice here, and I need your help. So either Maps of Science or Vivo. How many of you would be interested to hear more about mapping science? God, this is going to be tricky. So maybe 10, 15, 20. What about Vivo, National Researcher Network, and how it could potentially also be linked to the hub infrastructure? Because I think it would help you to create communities which know immediately from day one a lot about themselves. So maybe that's 5. All right, so I go with the map and science part. And again, there will be more slides in the end of this presentation about what Vivo can do today and what it will soon be able to do. I was originally asked to talk about the Atlas of Science. However, there's a copy upstairs. I submitted the files 2 years ago, so you can just read it if you want. It's also very visual, so you can just, if you like maps, you can just browse it this way. Our interest was, and my personal interest was, to make people understand that Earth is beautiful and we should preserve it, but science itself and also science and technology and the evolution of both is almost as beautiful. So this is where the Atlas comes in. And you can get it at Amazon for less than $20. It makes a great present for anybody who's interested in science. He got some really cute remarks that somebody got it for his kids to interest them in science. And then he figured out that he actually doesn't want them to touch that book with their sticky little fingers. But then he also kind of did this LOL at the end. The issue with Vivo, but also with mapping science and science of science studies efforts, is that we are all kind of bombarded by data. And you could just look in your email inbox and see that there are probably more emails than you can humanly process in 24 hours each day, and there's an issue. And so the question becomes, how can we actually still find our way to promising lands? How can we find good collaborators and ultimately also friends? And how can we identify trends in the landscape of science? So what are the new emerging areas? What are the hot topics? What are the new funding opportunities? What are the areas of research which attracted a lot of good young brains? Because typically the old brains don't move much. It's the young generation which goes to the new promising lands. And this black box we are trying to fill with data sets which are digitized, which are compatible with the semantic web. We try to fill it with algorithms that are useful for not only domain experts, but also for those which are in the trenches, which are trying to do science policy, which are trying to lead a directory, lead a center or a lab, and ultimately also with means to render that data. As you might know, the first early maps of our planet were not perfectly correct. There were no standards. There was no visual language. There was no up and down. There were no latitude, longitude information. They were beautiful. They had monsters in them, which are also very gorgeously drawn. But they were very far from being correct. The early maps of science, I would argue, are at a similar state of the art. So we know we miss a lot of data. One reason for me to be very happy to be here is that the different hub environments actually get us a lot more data than we typically have for studying science. Oftentimes, all we have is publications, patents, grants, funding data, and maybe more recently also science blogging and Twitter data. What we completely miss is data about scientific data and their use and usage and all the trading which goes on around scientific data, as well as scientific software artifacts, be it code pieces, APIs, tools, usage of cyber infrastructure. All this data is very important for understanding the inner workings of science, and we have very little access to this right now. Also, I should put in a plug for non-English-speaking science. There's a lot of science out there which does not get written up in English, and still it's incredibly relevant. For instance, in the Netherlands, they have a lot of good information on how to build dams and how to protect large areas of their land from flooding. And I think this kind of information would be very important for disasters which happened here and in other places on this planet. And even though it doesn't get written up in English, it's very important to actually know about it. So here you have differences between 3D physically based maps, geospatial maps, and n-dimensional maps of all of science. Here in this particular case, actually, of geography, 10 years of abstracts submitted to their American conference. In 3D geospatial spaces, accuracy is typically measurable. There are trade-offs that have to do with granularity. There are 2D projections, which are very accurate at local levels. And there are centuries of experience. And then if you look on the right-hand side, accuracy is very difficult. We cannot take any one researcher and ask them to evaluate a map. Nobody knows all of science today. And there are also trade-offs which indirectly affect accuracy. All kinds of parameter settings in these long workflows which are needed to generate one map. 2D projections neglect a great deal of data. And then there are maybe decades of experience. However, both maps can become templates for overlaying other data, and you will see this in the subsequent slides. I wanted to interest you in the Mapping Science exhibit, which is actually on display upstairs in the poster version, so that you can see those maps of science. It's a 10-year, 10-iteration effort. Each year, 10 new maps get added. This year's maps are science maps as visual interfaces to digital libraries. The Science Maps for Scholars just debuted at University of Michigan. A Science Map for Science Policymakers last year's debut at Stanford University. It's a physical beast, comes in big crates. You need a forklift to get it anywhere. Doesn't fit in my office anymore. In the beginning it did, but then you had to climb over it to get to my desk. It's a physical beast. It's not like a paper which you submit and then it's out of your life. This thing is needs care. You need to it arrives on your campus and you have to deal with it because in the way. But then in this exhibit, you have early maps of science compared and contrasted to early maps of our world. So always 4 on the left-hand side and then see 6 maps on the right-hand side. And you see they use very different metaphors to render science as a network, as a tree map, as a geospatial landscape, as a subway metaphor, as a cross map, as a kind of star sky, if you wish. Second iteration is all on the power and value of reference systems. And there are many different areas of science which have generated important reference systems for themselves. And the question is, how many dimensions does it take to render science? Does it take 1, just time? Do you need 2? Do you need a geospatial map and you overlay data? Do you need a topic map and you overlay data? Do you want to show dynamics over time? Third iteration is on the power of forecasts. Again, different forecasts have been done for different purposes, be it seismic hazard evaluations, be it epidemic spreading, be it economic forecasting, be it oil depletion. In how far can we forecast science? And there are some elements which you can see in the exhibit of how this might be done, using experts to do a 50-year forecast for a UK client of science technology developments, or do more automatic means based on very large-scale data sets. The 2008 iteration was on science maps for economic decision makers. What do they need to know? And notice that we really wanted to have a happiness map in that iteration also. It's not just about money. In the third iteration, you see the map of science, the so-called UCSD map of science, because UCSD had the resources and also the forward thinking, if you wish, to use very large-scale data sets, ISI, Thomson Reuters, and Scopus by Elsevier combined, a 5-year time period, to render a base map of science. And you see here how mass via physics, chemistry, the CERN one is astronautical, chemical, mechanical, civil engineering, earth sciences, biology, infectious diseases, medical specialties, health professionals, brain research and social sciences, with this little kind of Australia to the arts and humanities, is interconnected. And it would be very interesting to me to overlay the different usage patterns, form diverse hubs onto this map, and to see who is really using it, from what areas, and in which ways. So there is obviously input of expertise and data sets and algorithms which goes into a hub, but then there are also users from different areas of science which are actually using that particular hub. And I think these flow patterns are very interesting to understand. In the iteration on science maps for science policy making, you have this map which shows delays and feedback cycles in the science system. So here you see how $1 billion of federal funding is matched by the chemical industry to result in a much larger budget for chemical development and productization, which then results via the chemical industry operating income in a lot of GNP growth and jobs, and via the economy back in taxes and then again federal funding. You also see, and it's hard to read on the projector here, but it's fine to read in the slides and on my screen, that there are delays in the science system. So there are about 4 to 5 years for foundational research. There are 9 to 11 years for invention development, and there are more than 5 years for technology commercialization. So if you give any of us $1 million and you expect to go from an idea to a ready product, it's just not going to work. Even if you give us more dollar, it's just not, there are delays in that system. And I think we would be all benefiting from understanding them better. If you're wondering what the exhibit adds to original work, this is the yellow arrow graph, which actually made it to Congress. It was used in a testifying exercise. We then started to work with the Chemical Council, Research Council, and ended up with the exhibit, which is now in the map, which is now in the exhibit. Another map which I wanted to bring up is the clickstream map of science. Maybe the closest to the kind of usage activity data you have in the hub environments. Here you see how the different scientific papers are downloaded. And whenever two papers are downloaded, one after the other, they are connected by a non-directed link, so the linkages are lost in this map. However, you see that there are major areas which are, for instance, looking at the biomedical research papers. Lots of them are used in doctors' offices. They might not result in follow-up papers and citations. However, they are used in practice. And so this map, for the very first time, does not only show the number of papers and the citations, which are oftentimes coupled with how much funding goes in an area, but really shows how science is used. It also shows how the arts and humanities here in yellow keep the hardcore sciences here rendered in blue together via these download linkages and click streams. This is a display at Stanford University of the exhibit. The maps are 24 by 30, so if you're interested to display it at your university, we are always curious to see where this exhibit might go, and we work very closely with venues. The exhibit also features a so-called illuminated diagram display, a touch panel, and two screens, one of a map of the science, all of science, and one of a map of the world. And you can then touch any area in the map of the world, and you will see in the map of science what kind of research is performed in that geospatial location. And similarly, if you touch chemistry or anorganic chemistry, you will see highlight in the map of the world who is conducting this kind of research. These are the crates. And if you have a train station, it's actually a very nice way to get science to come to you. We recently had the exhibit, or part of the exhibit, in a train, which made it to 62 cities in 7 months. It's a wonderful way to get many, many people to interact with science. I wanted to make sure that you go away not only understanding that you can now render science on a large scale, but also that you can bring those maps online and have people interact with those maps. One of those efforts are just counts. So there are many sites out there now which very nicely calculate your age index, your Gini index, your G index, your all kinds of other indexes which you might like or not like to have on your forehead. And I think it's very hard to judge anybody based on one number, but people love these numbers because they consort them, they can apply a threshold, and everybody above gets tenured, get funded, everybody below does not get it. Fortunately, in the U.S., people have a more holistic interest in understanding what people really contribute to science. And so I think it's a very widely used way of analyzing science, but potentially there are better ways. One of my collaborators, actually several of my collaborators, they have this map of science website rendered by SciTech Strategies, so Kevin Boyack, Dick Clavens. In these maps, you can see the core competencies of different institutions, of different people, of different nations, and it's now also integrated in SciVal by Elsevier. So it's actually now part of a commercial product, having science maps there available to those which can afford them, can pay for that service. Another map which might be of interest to you is a map of philanthropy, which, again, you can access here at this online site. One other rendering of science, which a PhD student of mine and PhD student from the School of Information and Computing, Informatics and Computing at IU did, is a map of job postings. So you take RSS feeds of job feeds, and you render them, overlay them on the map of the US in this case, but also on the map of science. And of course, you can click on those bubbles and you can see the listing of all the jobs, and you can click on a specific posting and you can get more information on the right-hand side panel. And you can go link to posts to actually apply for it. But you can also overlay them on a map of science, and you can get to see what kind of jobs are offered in what kind of areas of science. In a recent project, we wanted to get an overview of sustainability research in terms of publications, funding, and patents. And so here we have 7 different data sets, 3 different types of funding, 3 different types of publications, and then the USPTO patents. And you can overlay them again over the geospatial map of the US in this case, and geospatial map of science. And you can interact with it by clicking and selecting certain types of data overlays, by running searches, and also getting more information about the data at the state level, but then ultimately also at the city level. So you can zoom in, and then you get to see all the papers, patents, grants per city in this particular interface. You can search for corn, and there will be a lot of larger icons in the middle of the country. You can search for oil spills, and you will see a lot on the coastline, and you can search for very specific queries that might be more of interest to you. So here we can also click on, for instance, Florida. We get to see what kind of papers exists there, and you can click on these links on the right-hand side, and you end up in front of the DOE OSTI information bridge. And you can search for other query terms, and again, get more information on the respective funding. And you can do the same for the Map of Science. So it's just a different base map which you now use to overlay data either at the 13 discipline level, which corresponds to the state level, or at the 554 fields of science level. And these fields are also color-coded to help you understand what areas are where. And similarly, again, you can click on any of those icons and get more information on what papers exactly have been published in this area or what funding helped support this area of science. And you end up, again, in front of a relevant U.S. patent databases here in this case. Some of my students recently created a little company in Bloomington, Indiana. They are called Chalk Labs, so if you are interested to get something like this built for yourself, they are always interested to collaborate with clients and to make money and to grow. What they recently did with the National Institutes of Health is the so-called NIH Map Viewer, which uses a base map of NIH funding and overlays of relevant search results to help program officers understand the overlap in terms of different funding patterns for specific topics, but also for specific research areas that might be co-funded by different institutes. And what you have here is abstracts of those awarded funding records and topic modeling, which extracts relevant terms from those. And based on the topics, then you can render a base map of NIH funding. And then again, a search, for instance, for cancer would result in the insights that NCI is funding most of it. But there are other institutes which also fund cancer research. You get to see major title words and their loadings in terms of topic factors. And you get to see renderings of specific grants. And you can, again, zoom in to these listings and explore it in more detail. You can also go to a specific grant. You get to see its topics. You get to see similar grants. And you can start exploring the landscape of funded grants and the institutes that fund them. You can also, on the map, then request a map of similar grants. And you see the specific grant which you had selected and similar grants as they distribute themselves over the map of science. And there might be very specific reasons why you have pockets of different types of grants in different areas. You might also have seen the R&D dashboard, which recently became available, which actually uses NIH exporter data to provide a very simple, easy-to-use interface for different stakeholders. And you could go to Illinois or go to Indiana and search for all the NSF NIH awards for certain years, and you get a listing of all those awards, and you can do the same for publications. So there are very different ways now to interact with these kind of data sets. What I don't get to do, but I have two more minutes, and I'm going to show you what you don't get to see, is science and technology studies using semantic web data. It might be very interesting for you to also think about interfaces of the Hub Zeros or all the hubs which are out there to the semantic web. I find it very empowering to actually connect to this very quickly growing and growing and growing linked open data cloud. We now have these three bubbles in here, which are the Vivo bubbles. I think it could be very interesting to see some hub bubbles in there as well. And it's a lot of high-quality data which becomes available. Inside the large-scale Vivo project, you now have a number of these visualizations you just saw. You have collaboration networks. You can, of course, access the RDF data itself. But then you can also render the data in different ways, and you can always download the data in easy-to-process formats. And in the interest of time, I wanted to leave you with more information on other efforts we are running, including these plug-and-play macroscopes. There's a video now and a paper on those, thanks to ACM, on the SciV side, which tells how we build infrastructures where you can plug-and-play data sets and algorithms where computer scientists have to create the core, the empty core, just like they had to create Flickr and YouTube sites. But then anybody, domain experts, social scientists, physicists, they can now take their code, wrap it up, and make it available in those tools. And domain scientists are going to use these tools, and a way to get new algorithms into your tool is to take a JAR file, have it sent to you by an email or download it from an online website, plug and play it in your tool by simply copying that JAR file in your plugin directory. It shows up in your menu system and you can use it. So this is a different way to empower a lot of domain experts and others, which are also now starting to use those tools, to share not only papers and patents and grant data with each other, but to also share algorithms with each other. Thank you very much.
Any questions for Caddy? I love all those maps. You guys should go upstairs and check them out firsthand. They're amazing. Yeah. Oh, Mike.
Do you need to swap those out?
Mm-hmm. Caddy, I was interested in your talking about exposing hub data to the semantic web. What kinds of links do you think are appropriate? What kinds of vocabularies would you suggest if you were to expose the hub's content and metadata and semantics to linked open data cloud? What kinds of connections would you suggest based on your knowledge of the hubs?
So currently in the linked open data cloud, you have people data. So if you have clean people IDs, which I think you have because you keep track of who is logging into your hub, so that would be one way of doing it, especially if there are Vivo instances which have some of your users already in them. I think then it is also interesting to get their Vivo profiles. You saw the RDF record of my own data into the hub. So it's a two-way street, actually. So you benefit by getting more high-quality institutional profiles from Vivo. But at the same time, what the linked open data would gain would be usage activity data on what kind of algorithms they use, what data sets they access. So people, I think, are the main connector because they are the drivers of science. On the other hand, I believe you also have publication data. So there are many bubbles out there which are just purely publication data. You might have geolocations. DBpedia is the biggest node, so many of the Hubble bubbles connect to it. There might be... So again, there's not much on data or algorithms in the linked open data. That would be a unique contribution which the hub could make. So I would start with geolocations, people, publications.
Thanks.